Okay, good evening. I guess we'll begin. And as I just mentioned, I hope that the dwindling in attendance in the shul over the years is not an indication of a lack of interest in Pesach, Chas v'Shalom. It's just I think that hopefully people are have learned the routine, and maybe all of the information that is available now, through the online emails and the various websites, will provide people with all the information that they need. Be that as it may, we're not going to make any assumptions here, and I think the chazara, the review, is always helpful. I know for myself, and what we're going to do, as we've done in the past, is the following. I'm going to try to give as brief an overview as possible regarding the basic laws that we need to keep in mind regarding Pesach. And then, I will open the floor for any questions that you may have. Usually people have their own specific questions regarding their own circumstances, and we can discuss it at that time. And obviously any questions, comments, interjections along the way, so the floor is open for you to comment as well. As we know, traditionally, this is a very hectic time of year for everyone on different levels. And one of the reasons why the preparation for Pesach is so much more intense and so much more demanding than the preparation for the other Chagim is because we have luring over our heads this idea that the penalty for violating the prohibitions of Chametz is so severe that it motivates us to take it particularly seriously. If one would compare, for example, the consequences of one sitting in a sukkah which is not kosher to one who ate chametz on Pesach, so we realize, of course, that it's almost something that cannot be compared. The penalty for eating chametz on Pesach to one who did so intentionally is so severe, so that's what makes us all crazy and all concerned, and as a result of which we prepare in ways that that demand a tremendous amount of time and effort and intensity. I'm here to make you feel a little better about it, and I'm here to tell you that despite the fact that it's true, and I will not deny that there is in fact a severe penalty that the Torah presents for one who violates the issur of eating chametz on Pesach, nevertheless, we don't have to make ourselves crazy, more so than obviously we're going to feel because of the natural pressure of this time. So I'm not here to tell you that that you don't have to prepare and you have nothing to be worried about, but I do want to try to put everybody at ease, as I've done in the past, to remind you that if mistakes are made and things are overlooked, more often than not, it's not really the end of the world. And sometimes it may be, or close to it, as we'll discuss. Now, there are three basic areas of prohibition in relation to chametz. The first and perhaps the most well-known is that there is an issue of achilas chametz, that one is not permitted to eat chametz of the Yom Tov of Pesach. In Eretz Yisrael, that's 7 days, here that's 8 days. And already that prohibition of eating chametz begins midway through Erev Pesach. We actually put up even a little earlier, but let's say midway through Erev Pesach the prohibition begins, and that extends until after Pesach. Even though in a Torah, on a Torah level, one would have to actually eat a kazayas's worth of chametz, which is the size of an olive. We don't think in terms of olives typically, but let's say in relation to bread, let's say one would have to eat half a slice of bread, maybe even a little more than that, in order to have violated the prohibition on a Torah level. Nevertheless, we still assume that there's a prohibition, perhaps also on a Torah level, to eat even the smallest amount. And we are more strict in this regard with chametz than we are with most other prohibited foods in the Torah, because normally we have a concept of bittul, which means that if I'm preparing a shalom to Erev Shabbos and someone accidentally shakes their baby bottle and a drop of milk goes in, so as long as we have 60 times meat to milk, so then we're okay. That's the concept of bittul. The milk becomes batel, becomes nullified, lost in the meat. That concept of bittul does not apply on Pesach, that if chametz, in theory, I mean, obviously it's not a very practical case, but if a person would have, a big pot as big as his room, and it was filled with the Pesach dish, and one little drop of chametz would fall in, So then the din would be that we would not be able to eat that entire thing. Obviously, that again, it's a very, very extreme case, but that illustrates that without exception, we do not apply the concept of bittul. That would already begin to give us a little bit of an inkling as to why we are so strict around the kitchen. We do not want little pieces of bread here and there, perhaps flying off of the top of the oven, on the stovetop, or the range, etc., because of, again, the fact that there is no bittul. That's in relation to achilas chametz. As well, there's a prohibition of benefiting from chametz, of hanah. And this is different, because although whenever a person eats, they enjoy, even though you may be thinking, not necessarily, sometimes I just eat because I'm bored, and sometimes I eat because I'm not, okay, that's true, but halachically, when one eats, there is benefit. Benefit can come in other forms other than eating. So, for example, selling chametz and profiting from the sales is a form of hanah. Now, anybody has pets, so if I would feed my pet chametz, that's also hanah. I'm not benefiting in the traditional sense because I'm not eating it, but I'm benefiting because I need to feed my animal, and instead of having to feed him vegetables, so I fed him chametz products. So that as well is a form of hanah. So this as well is a prohibition, again, also on a Torah level. And then we find something which is unique to chametz, which we do not find in reference to any other Yisuri Achila in the Torah, any other foods that are prohibited for consumption, and that is, the Torah says, not only may you not eat it, and not only may you not benefit from it, you may not even own it. And this is known as the prohibition of Baal Yeira'e or Baal Yimatzeh. The Torah says you may not even have it in your possession, and this would apply even if I'm not going to have any access to it, if I'm not going to see it. For example, if I'm going to be in Eretz Yisrael Chi Yom Tov, so I'm still not permitted to own chametz in America, and vice versa. So if I'm not going to be in my office, I'm taking off vacation for a week, I'm still not permitted to own chametz that's in a different location. So a Jew, in preparation for Pesach, has to see to it that he is not going to eat chametz, he's not going to benefit, and may not even own chametz. So although I started off by saying I'm going to put you at ease, it sounds like, again, we're building a case over here that, my gosh, this is just an impossible scenario. So the good news is that Chazal have advised us through various related activities, which have become almost somewhat routine to many of us, that there is a way that we can ultimately almost assure ourselves that we will not come even accidentally to violate these important prohibitions. So first and foremost, what we're going to do is we're going to have, I will say, an informal and then a formal bedikas chametz. The informal bedikas chametz has been taking place. In fact, you know, many of you perhaps have just left your bedikas chametz and will return to your bedikas chametz when you leave here this evening. Although the formal bedikas chametz with the candle and the feather does not begin until the night of Erev Pesach, already bedikas chametz begins in many homes days and weeks in advance. The bedikas chametz obviously is followed by a destruction of that chametz, which can come in different forms. The traditional way we destroy chametz is by burning it, but one does not have to burn all of his chametz. It's certainly advisable that one leaves a little behind to burn on Erev Pesach. But a person can give that chametz away to a non-Jew, obviously, to give it to a Jew, unless the Jew is going to eat it all beforehand, would not really accomplish all that much. I can do anything I want with it, but I have until, again, approximately midday, although it's a little beforehand, it's approximately 11:40 here in Teaneck this year on Erev Pesach, to make sure that I've gotten rid of all of my chametz. In addition, I do what's called a bittul. A bittul is a legal declaration where I essentially say that all chametz that I may have in my possession, that I forgot about, that I have not found, and therefore have not been able to get rid of, does not belong to me, and I'm declaring it ownerless, and I can care less about it. So this way, even if perhaps I did forget about a box of donuts under my mattress, I know that sounds like a disgusting thought to some of you, but I'm sure you've maybe from time to time found food in strange places in your homes. So even if I forgot that there is that there actually may be some chametz that I never found, I've said a bittul, and that has covered myself, even though I'm not going to eat it on Pesach, certainly, but this way I will not be in violation of the issue of Ayreba Yimatzeh because I do not own it. And in addition, we go beyond that, and we have a mechiras chametz, whereby we sell our chametz, any chametz that we may intentionally want to retain and to keep ownership of after Pesach, in addition to a mechiras chametz on things that we may not even know about. Now, I want to make the point that I actually gave a shiur this Shabbos afternoon to the men And I imagine most of you, not all of you, were not here at the time, but just to make the point, and I'm not going to speak extensively about the Mechiras Chametz, but I want all of you to know that the Mechiras Chametz is a real binding Mechira, even though it seems somewhat staged, and it seems almost humorous, the way everybody comes to the rabbi and says, I'd like to appoint you a shliach to start my Chametz, and I'm taking the Chametz, I'm putting it in the closet, and I know it's going to be there after Pesach. And never in a million years could we ever imagine a scenario where the non-Jew is actually going to come on Pesach and claim his chametz, despite the fact that you're right, that the odds of that happening are so unlikely for many reasons. Nevertheless, the sale is 100% binding on a halachic level and on a civil level as well, that we arrange the sale of chametz in a manner that it is recognized in a civil court of law, which would give the non-Jew complete and total advantage, and he would be able to literally go ahead into your homes with your permission. He doesn't have access to your homes without you opening the door from him. You know, he's not buying your house, but he would be able to go when he wants and claim that chametz for himself. The only catch on his end is that after Pesach, we're going to have to sit down and assess the actual value. He's going to have to pay for it. Right now, he puts down a down payment. So if the rabbi sells him $1 million worth of chametz, he's only putting down $20. It's all his, but he's actually going to have to pay the rest to keep it. But I want to make the point, for nothing else other than these, just know that it's real, and people should take it seriously. And in fact, one who does not take it seriously, and as a result, maybe will lock up the chametz and not tell anyone where the key is. So according to the Mishnah Berurah, for example, such a sale is not valid. The person shows that they had absolutely no intention of selling it at all because they're locking the door and not allowing the buyer to even access it. So that indicates certainly to us that the mechira, that the sale is good. Now, I'm telling you all this because I want to put you at ease, and everybody should realize that if we take these basic precautionary measures and do a bdikas chametz and ultimately rid ourselves of chametz and a bittul chametz and a mechiras chametz, when all is said and done, certainly no question about it, when it comes to the prohibition of owning chametz on Pesach, we have nothing to worry about. We have nothing to worry about because even again, if I did forget something, I'm covered on many levels. What we do have to worry about, however, is seeing to it that our homes, and specifically, really most importantly, our kitchens, are 100% chametz free. And the reason for that is because now it's not a question of ownership, it's just a question of consumption. I'm not permitted to eat a non-Jew's chametz on Pesach. I mean, forget the question, I may not own it. But, and being that we start off by saying there is no bittul on Pesach, so we want to be extremely careful around the kitchen. So our craziness in the kitchen, and especially when dealing with appliances, with ovens, countertops, is well founded and is something that we should continue, and I don't want to discourage you from that. Ripping up the carpets around the house and moving heavy pieces of furniture and taking down the blinds and doing all sorts of spring cleaning, very sometimes difficult activities, is nice. And if you want to do it, because spring cleaning is always a great thing to do, so then again, tavo aleichem bracha. I'm not here to discourage you per se, but save that for last, because if a person is going to place all of their time and energy on these types of efforts, which are not really required in order to have a chag kosher, and then they're not going to have the energy that's necessary to either kosher the kitchen properly, or just as importantly, to be able to be mekayim the mitzvah of simchas chachag, and to be mekayim the mitzvahs of the seder properly. I needn't remind you, but I will, that women are obligated in the mitzvahs of the night of the seder just as men are. And the reason I say that is because we know, of course, that when it comes to various holidays throughout the year, that's not the case. When it comes to the mitzvah of sukkah, so we know already, a woman can sit in the sukkah, she can make a bracha, but the bottom line is, when all is said and done, she is exempt and does not have to sit in the sukkah on sukkahs. When it comes to Pesach, a woman is obligated to eat matzah like a man. She's obligated to drink dalat kosos like a man. She's obligated to sipur yetzias mitzrayim like a man. And halal. So there really are no differences. But we know that traditionally, women, by the time they come to the Seder, so you'll forgive me, I don't mean this, the expression, a woman feels like a shmata, and again, maybe on a certain level it can't be avoided. just because, again, the natural tension leading up to Yom Tov. But I implore you to consider that the you know, extra efforts and toil around the house, which are not, certainly not required, and perhaps, again, not even accomplish anything in terms of making a house more kosher for Pesach, at the expense of being able to enjoy and to celebrate at the Seder properly, I personally don't believe that it's justified, and we should try to whatever extent possible to plan in advance to have as restful as possible. And you're laughing at me when I'm saying this, but as restful as possible a few days leading up to Pesach. And I understand nobody's going to be resting literally, but it could be less hectic than perhaps it's been in the past. Now I know I've always heard people say, but I always saw my mother do. So again, I'm not here to tell you not to take the blinds down. And if that's what your mother did, and she still does, and those memories are something that you cherish, so I don't want to deny you that right. But I do feel that I have the responsibility to tell you that unless, from time to time when no one's looking, you actually start licking your blinds and maybe would actually dip the challah onto the carpet, you know, you have nothing to worry about because it's not going to end up in your mouth. And as far as ownership is concerned, we've already dealt with that. We did a mechir, we did a bittul. And to begin with, crumbs of chametz, a person would not be in violation of the Yisur by Rabbi Matzi anyway. So I don't mean to come across as cynical or in any way, I'm not poking fun of people who do go to these extremes, because it is noteworthy, and it is something which is, on certain levels, something which is admirable to see such devotion on a religious level. But we do have to prioritize and keep in mind that that there is, you know, a set of priorities over here which is sometimes a little mixed up. I want to make another... Is your hand up? I couldn't tell. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Did you talk about books?
You mean cleaning out books?
Yeah.
No. What would you like me to say? That, no, should we clean out books?
Some people strap up their farm shelves and only...
Use certain books. Right, so I would say the following. You know, that's not as crazy as you think. Why? Because if a person or persons in the family from time to time do bring Sfarim to the table and will eat over a Sefer, it is not uncommon at all, you know, we don't necessarily notice these things otherwise, to take a Sefer that's commonly used at the Shabbos table and shake it, and you'll find all sorts of crumbs flying out. After all, let's find me a Haggadah that doesn't have pieces of matzah falling out of it. I mean, it is so that's not so crazy, especially if that would then be brought to the Pesach table. Again, on Pesach, we will not tolerate a mashehu, even a crumb of chametz around food, around the table, anywhere near our mouths. So the notion of cleaning books may not be as absurd as changing, you know, the blinds in the bedroom, which is nowhere near the kitchen. It all depends on the situation at the home. And again, people should know for themselves based on... There is a principle in halacha that you don't have to check for chametz in places where you know for sure it was never brought. So, I hate to say it, some people, you know, the Sfarim are never... Forget by the tables. Some people, maybe money, the Sfarim are never opened at all. So I know there's no chametz there because I haven't opened since before last Pesach or beforehand. So then you don't have any more of an obligation to look there than I do in my attic that I haven't been in since 2 years ago. But again, Sfarim that are from time to time brought to the table, that is a good place to actually make sure that they are clean and chametz free, especially, again, that they may find their ways back to the table. I want to make another comment in reference to the Seder, and I'll go over a couple of rules regarding koshering, as we've done in the past, mention another point, and then open the floor for any questions you may have. I mentioned the point before that the mitzvos at the Seder apply equally to men and women. If we would have a lot of time here, so we could discuss and analyze that perhaps the type and the nature of certain obligations may differ somewhat, but for the most part there are no differences. And it's important for you to realize that, to the women and to the men, and for your husbands and wives to realize that as well. I've heard, and unfortunately I usually find this, people come with questions after the first Seder, despite the fact that I've tried so often in the past to inform people in advance as to the proper way to prepare for the Seder. I hear from time to time about people who feel that the mitzvos, specifically eating mitzvos at the Seder, are difficult for the average, or not necessarily average, but for people to handle. And it's not uncommon for me to get a question the morning after Pesach, what do? Last night I was only able to drink 2 cups of wine. So I'm not going to say that it's impossible, and I'm not going to say that everyone out there can tolerate wine and they're just being very difficult for no reason. I recognize, of course, that because of people's various conditions and states, physically, medically, so there may be certain limitations that people have. But I want to remind you, or perhaps inform you if you didn't realize this before, that if you prepare, again, for the Seder, the average person will be more than fine. Let me explain what I mean. There is an obligation to drink 4 cups of wine. And again, that obligation applies to men and women equally. Now, a cup can mean different things. This is a cup, and this is a cup, and this cup, and this cup. Now, the trick is you have to drink at least the majority of the cup, at least a row of cups. Ideally, you should drink the whole cup, but you don't have to. 51%, regardless of the size of the cup that you have. So if you have a 20-ounce cup, so you have to drink at least 10 ounces per cup. That's a lot of wine. I mean, again, unless you're used to drinking that much wine, you know, most people cannot tolerate that. You should, if you know that you have some intolerance towards wine, or let's be honest, it's late at night, you're tired, so even if you're not so intolerant towards wine, you're probably going to, you know, be affected by the wine that you drink at the Seder. So I would encourage you to find for yourself a kos, a cup that holds 3 ounces. Ideally, shouldn't be less, 2.9. If you want to be very exact, maybe even 3.3 would be better. But if you look for a 3-ounce cup, you're safe. And this, again, works for men and women. Now you have the kos that you're going to use at the Seder. And all you have to do, again, is to drink half of this, or a little teeny more than half, 4 times. So that you're looking right now at a total of 6 ounces throughout the night, which is not so much. I think a can of soda is 12 ounces, right? That's not so bad. Again, that's spread out over the night. And as well, you don't have to use 12% alcohol wine, or even 10, or even 7. They have now 3%, and that's wine, and it's no more of a hither. It's not considered any more of a mitzvah for a person to drink a wine with a higher percentage of alcohol. If a normal, healthy person prepares in this way, then most people will be able to get through the Seder just fine, and the wine will not throw them over the edge. And this is obviously a way to encourage and to invite, children, certainly let's talk about boys and girls over the age of Bar Mitzvah, which are also children in some regard, but have an obligation just as we do. We should bear that in mind. So, you know, there are certainly, it's conceivable that a 12-year-old girl can't drink all this wine. Because if you get the shiurim right, and you get the right wine, it's not all that much. Still, if someone absolutely cannot do it, so you can mix wine with grape juice, and if need be, actually even use grape juice. But I would, again, encourage people to have a little more confidence in themselves, and in all likelihood, if they prepare beforehand, they should be okay.
I think that you can just fill the little kiddish cups with wine to the brim. Are those 3 ounces?
You mean the shot
glasses? Yeah.
Those are not 3 ounces. No, it's probably, I don't know, maybe a little less than 1 ounce. Maybe even less, right? I don't know how much. I'm sorry?
1 ounce,
exactly. So.
But 1 ounce
is enough.
It's like, let's say you have a 3 ounce cup.
If you have a 3 ounce cup and you drink half, it's going to be a little more than 1.5 ounces. Right.
Okay.
Right. But you can't use a shot glass and fill it up twice. You need to have a cup that holds at least 3 ounces. Right?
So you can have all the other 4.5 ounces even of wine the whole night.
Was my math off?
No.
1.5 times 4.
Right.
So 6 ounces. 6 ounces, right. 1.5 times 4, 6 ounces throughout the night. Okay? Yeah. No, it doesn't have to be red. It's brought down that it's actually more of a hither, which means it's not necessarily, it's not that you cannot get the mitzvah with white wine, but because of various reasons that have been suggested, it's considered more appropriate for the Seder to have red wine. If you have white wine, which is a better quality wine or more tasty, then according to some right then and there, it's no longer a hitter to use the red wine. That alone is a reason. Although some recommend that if you're going to use white wine, to pour a little red wine in to give it a red look. And that way, you know, you've accomplished all that you would have accomplished otherwise. Yeah.
If you're doing that, does the order that you pour the wine...
Perhaps maybe you should pour the red wine in first and pour the white wine over it. Right. Right.
Is that
you have to do it that way?
No, is that one of the rules of Yom Tov or
Shabbos? No, that would be, it wouldn't be the Shabbos and Yom Tov in that regard. If we would be concerned about coloring foods, so it would be the same on Shabbos and Yom Tov. It is a chumrah, but it's a noteworthy one, and perhaps, you know, if you think in advance, it would be best to color the wine by putting the red wine in the cup first and then the white wine afterwards. That's to not give the appearance they're actually coloring the wine. When it comes to matzah as well, now obviously matzah is matzah. There's no grape juice when it comes to matzah. There are different types of matzahs for people who are allergic to wheat. They have spelt matzahs and oat matzahs, but for the average person, there's not much that we can do. The recipe is what it is. Here as well, again, I feel bad apologizing. I sound like I'm apologizing for the matzah. It is, if we only realize it, a tremendous opportunity to be mekayim a very special mitzvah on a very special night. If we're thinking about the taste only, and again, some people like matzah, but others don't, but just thinking about the fact that it hurts my mouth when I chew, if that's our focus, then of course we're not going to appreciate all that much. Still get the mitzvah, but you know, better we should have an attitude of excitement and anticipation. I know I've told this story in the past. I don't know if I've told it here. I'll just tell you very quickly about the Seder. I was once at my in-laws, so going back probably about 10 years ago, and there were among the guests, the whole story in its own right in terms of describing what that Seder looks like, but there were people from the former Soviet Union, and we were all complaining about the matzah. It didn't taste that good. That was a little chewy. We were all catching and complaining. And to make a long story short, because I know some of you heard this before, there was a guy who got up, and he told us this whole story, how when he was growing up in Russia, they used to get matzah delivered every year. And then one year it didn't come, and it came the day after Pesach. So they thought nothing of it, other than the fact that they had been unfortunate. And the next year the same thing happened again. And then they realized that the KGB was intercepting the deliveries, and specifically, you know, holding it off until intentionally, so after Pesach, to taunt and to torture the Jews. And then they came up with a great chak. What were they going to do? They saved the matzah until the next year. So every year, he said, for about 10 years, they ate matzah that was made probably a year and a half earlier. And he was telling us how good it tasted. And how much of a delight it was. And obviously, we felt very, very bad and very small. But the point is, again, usually we are very selective of what we put in our mouth. But it is, it's a unique opportunity, and it's a special night. And our children, of course, should never see us complain about mitzvahs in general, but about the taste. They should see our excitement, and they understand that this is not something that is delicious. They don't normally see us sitting down and just snacking on some matzah, but the impact that we can make on them either way is very profound. So we should try to be mindful that the mitzvahs, which sometimes seem somewhat burdensome and uncomfortable, should be, again, met with a different approach, and again, with adequate preparation beforehand, usually you'll be fine. I'll point out another trick, and if you don't like chewy matzahs, if you put them in the oven a little bit beforehand, they tend to get a little more crispy. So I'm sure, Judy, this year you're aiming to get only the crispiest matzahs anyway. But
358 pounds.
Right.
Yeah.
But just in case, your box is a little. I should point out as well that despite the fact that we order our matzahs from a matzah factory that is very reputable and does have hashgacha, there are many, many things that can go wrong when making a matzah. So therefore, if you see any significant folds or big bubbles or things that just don't look like a flat matzah should look, you don't have to panic. You don't have to throw it out of the house and flush it down the toilet. But I wouldn't use it. Wouldn't use it on Pesach. Certainly not fair. We use it at all. Hopefully you have enough matzah to cover yourself. Hopefully you're not going to find more, if you do, more than one or two of those in all the matzahs that you ordered. If that, and that would be a lot, but you should look. You shouldn't assume necessarily that every matzah that makes it into the bat is necessarily, I'm not even going to say chametz free, because that's going to scare some, but again, there are these things that that sometimes it was not flattened out adequately, etc. So we should look into this beforehand. One other point about this year, it's nothing unique per se about this year, but we didn't have it last year, so just quickly review the laws of Erev Tafshilin. Erev Tafshilin is made on Erev Yom Tov this year on Wednesday, a week from tomorrow. Ouch. And we do that in order to enable us to prepare from Yom Tov to Shabbos. A number of points that should be mentioned. Number one, the Erev allows us to all preparations for Shabbos. So if you know that you are not cooking for Shabbos, either because everything's been prepared beforehand, or you're going out for both meals, whatever the case is, you should still make an Erev Tafshilin, because it allows all other preparations, including even lighting candles. So there is no one who should not prepare an Erev Tafshilin for Shabbos. That's point number one. If you forget to do so after the fact, I don't want to talk about now what you do, because no one should forget, but after the fact, we'll talk. But you should make every effort not to forget, and you should make sure that you remember. You don't have to do it late in the day. Sometimes that's the mistake people make. They say, I knew all day I had to make it, and then I forgot. Don't do it then. Make an Erev Tafshilin earlier in the day, and that's fine. The second point I want to make is that preparations for Shabbos can only take place on Friday. They may not take, or on Thursday night, but they may not take place on the first day of Yom Tov. They may only take place on the second day of Yom Tov. So if I have extra time on Thursday afternoon, halavai, I still cannot prepare for Shabbos. I have to prepare for, and at that point I can't even prepare for Friday. So there's no preparation that can be... Right, exactly. So Thursday, you really can't prepare for anything other than something you may want to eat on Thursday afternoon. Friday, you can prepare for Friday, and you can prepare for Shabbos. And obviously Shabbos, we're limited to the same restrictions that we have every other Shabbos. And finally, one should ideally not prepare on Friday too close to Shabbos, especially now I'm talking specifically when it comes to cooking and baking. Anything like that should be done before... with enough time that, in theory anyway, if not, in reality, you would actually be able to serve a meal before Friday, before Shabbos begins. Now, we're going to make it a little easier for you, because we're davening Shabbos here, we're davening Maariv early here at Beth Aaron. This is one of the reasons why we're doing it. It's not the main reason. One of the reasons is because it's preferable for this reason, when the entire community accepts Shabbos earlier, so all the preparations are taking place earlier. But just to bear in mind, in general, and in case you may not be here for Yom Tov, your husband may daven somewhere else, whatever the case is, that you should try to take care of all preparations with a few hours or so before the onset of Shabbos. That's what I wanted to say about Erev Tafshilin. As always, being that I send those booklets out in the mail, I don't want to bore you by just reading through, products after products after products, but there are two product points that I always make, and I want to repeat at this time, and that is that you must look out for products that are kosher for Pesach, but only for those who eat kidneyos. There are certain products out there that contain kidneyos, and do at the same time have a kosher for Pesach sign, or a symbol, hashgacha. And it says, in sometimes very small letters, la'och le'kidneyos. It's only kosher for those who eat the kidneyos. That's number one. Number two, there are certain products out there that are acceptable, but not permissible for people who are not in the category of being either cholim, sick people, or elderly people. There are products which are made from what's called matzah ashira, that the matzah is produced in a certain way which makes it a little softer, but the minhag is, and minhag with a capital M, I don't want to say that it's forbidden, but the strong minhag is, or maybe we'll say forbidden with a small s, is that people who are not in the category of elderly people, sick people, do not eat it. Now, for some reason, I still to this day do not understand, even the major kashrus organizations have still not, in my mind, done what I think is required of them in order of labeling boxes properly, or insisting that the manufacturers label it properly. But you'll sometimes see, for example, and I don't mean OU, but you'll see, for example, an OUP, and then in very small letters, or sometimes even on the side of the box, it'll say, it's OUP for who? So you should just be careful. I remember a few years ago, everybody got excited because Manashevich, someone started producing Pesach tam-tams. Everybody got so excited, whoa! And, word got out, after Pesach, that the truth is Yeah, it's true that they had the hashgacha, but it was matzah shira, and it's not really supposed to be consumed again by someone who is otherwise able to chew and to digest without any special medical limitations.
Is that acceptable for little babies?
Yeah, that would be acceptable for little babies. And finally, the point I wanted to make, just a general comment about cosmetics and medications and all those types of things, although they're different. And that is, I'm going to try to make it easier in case anybody has any questions in your mind about certain medications and cosmetics, that the position of many poskim, I'm going to say including myself, I'm not a posek, but my position is, in accordance with the view of the majority of poskim, that all medications that are in the form of pills or capsules or tablets and are swallowed, as opposed to chewed, are acceptable Pesach use, regardless of the ingredients. Meaning that even if you know that there's chametz in there, it's still okay. I gave a whole Shabbos Haggadah dress on this 2 years ago. I forgive you if you don't remember, if you weren't here, but you'll take my word for it. It'll take at least an hour to tell you why, but I can assure you there's nothing to worry about, and it's 100% acceptable. Why is it that there are books that are produced which have lists and lists and lists and lists? And the answer is because there are some who want the higher standards for themselves. But I'm just telling you that my position, the position I'm presenting you, is not a kula. It's not a leniency. That is the halacha, and you have nothing to be concerned about whatsoever. If you have medications that are chewable and have a taste to them, a pleasant taste, even if it's not delicious, but if they've been flavored, or a liquid medication, that's a completely different story. Completely different story. Then it is important that we ascertain A, what the ingredients are, and if we find that there are problematic ingredients, we still have to still look further as to what the need is, because I want to stress that no one should ever stop taking medication of any sort without discussing it, you know, carefully beforehand with a physician and then with someone who can help determine what the halacha is. Yes.
Okay. So what you're talking only about, like prescription. Not
over the counter as well.
Like aspirin,
Tylenol, Advil.
Okay.
Vitamins
are different stories.
I asked Rav Schechter about this a couple of years ago. He said vitamins would be no different. But I've discussed that with other poskim who felt very strongly when it came to medication. I was going to be concerned about. Thought that when it came to vitamins, if it was just for nutritional purposes and there was no medical need and was not advised by a physician. Then, in light of those other opinions, again, if you knew that it contained chametz, you know, you could do without it for 8 days. But again, Rav Schechter said it was okay. Far be it for me to disagree with him, but that position is not as mainstream as the other one that I just presented to when it comes to medications. Yes?
It's just what Mrs. Harris was saying about the vitamins. I have these vitamins that are like vitamin C, which I take like every day.
Mm-hmm.
They're from Israel, so I know they're kosher. They're like chewable, yummy.
Oh, really? We have to look into that. They're chewable, yummy, so we have to look.
Right.
And the fact that they're from Israel, I mean...
I need somebody to translate, because I really wouldn't know where to look.
Okay, so we'll talk afterwards, and we'll figure it out. But again, we're only talking about things that are swallowed and not chewable, and do not have a pleasant taste for them. When it comes to cosmetics, which includes soap and shampoos, and creams, any topical medications, lotions, all of these things, and many forms of cosmetics, makeup and the like, are also 100% acceptable for Pesach use, regardless of the ingredients that are contained within. What you do have to look out for is liquids such as perfumes and colognes and perhaps certain types of liquid types of creams that contain denatured alcohol. If you don't know how to identify that in the ingredients, the booklet I sent out, so I gave you a whole list of things to look out for, those again potentially could be problematic. And the reason for this is, the basis for everything actually until now is because these products are not edible. And in fact, not only they're not edible by humans, even dogs. You're never going to see a dog that's going to, you know, knock over the Advil bottle and start chewing on Advil. He's not going to do that because it's just not tasty to dogs. And therefore, it is no longer considered chametz as far as the prohibition of chametz is concerned. There have, unfortunately, been people who have been known out of sheer desperation, alcoholics and people who are just not well, to actually consume perfume and cologne and like. I mean, it is edible. It's not tasty, but it is edible and could contain alcohol, which is, because of the way it's been produced, considered to be chametz gamur. So that's where you have to be a little more careful. Lipstick, alpidin, lipstick as well, does not require any kosher supervision for the same reason, namely that it is not edible. Nevertheless, you do find, and again, it's sort of a steer, I don't understand it completely, but you do find that even those who say that you can take any medications, obviously lipstick being that it's placed on the lips and can easily be consumed, you do find some that say you should try to look for your lipsticks on the list and see to it, and if it does contain chametz, put it away. And certainly not discouraging you from following that position. Maybe it's a good idea. But certainly other types of medication, eyeliner, mascara, these types of things, nail polish, all of these things you don't have to be concerned about. Grains. Yeah, but it's not edible. It's not edible at all. You don't have to be concerned.
Even if it's got grains, nobody would eat.
Right. Toothpaste. Right, so, again, from the letter of the law, toothpaste as well is in the same category. They tell a story, it's like a legend, that that the Rav once said that toothpaste doesn't require, it's not Roy Lachilas Kelev, dogs would need it, and somebody went home, and he fed it to his dog, and his dog ate it. Came back to the Rav, and the Rav told him he has a stupid dog. That was his response. He stuck to his position. Toothpaste as well, being that most of the major name brands are acceptable, I think it would be appropriate, being again that it goes in the mouth, and it does have a pleasant taste to it, even though, again, people don't typically eat it, it would certainly be within the spirit, if nothing else, to make sure that the toothpaste that you want to use is on the list. You don't have to change your toothpaste tubes, even though the tradition / halacha is that we change our toothbrushes for obvious reasons. That is a good idea, to change your toothbrushes. It's a good idea to change them occasionally anyway. So once, you know, Pesach time is a good time. It's like included in that general spring cleaning category. But the toothpaste, I would recommend that you see to it that it's on the list. Again, most of the major name brands are all acceptable for Pesach use. I think that's all I want to tell you just in terms of the basic rules. And again, any questions? Now, koshering, I could stand here now for another 20 minutes and go through the koshering in the kitchen if you'd like, but I know that in the past, by now most people know what to do, and if you have questions about any particular appliance or procedure, I'll be happy to review it with you. But I know that your time is precious, and you know, I'd much rather field questions that you may have regarding koshering or anything like that. Yes?
What if one falls asleep during the Seder, either for the purposes of telling over the story or also for, say, after having two cups of wine or having a certain amount of matzah, if you were to fall asleep?
You mean that nobody woke you up? No.
For an hour.
Right.
You get two cups of wine, everybody's eating the meal, you right. For an hour, and then you come back to the table.
Right, so if you fell asleep in the middle of a meal, so it would be a question in terms of benching. That would be a serious question. And depending on where you fell asleep, I think, different questions would arise. I don't think there's a general rule as to if you fell asleep then. It would depend at which point of the Seder you fell asleep. You're not out.
In terms of you have to make up those two cups.
Right, so you'll make them up when you wake up. You'll get back into things. In other words, we're not going to say that since you fell asleep, you got to start again. From the beginning. We won't say that, but then again, you may have an issue in terms of benching, you know, which may affect, you know, the third cup and afikoman. So there are, it's not the question that hasn't been raised, but it really may depend on when you fall asleep. You'll ask me the next morning. or we'll try to, we'll look together afterwards and review the specifics depending on where you fall asleep. Yes?
What are people doing about romaine lettuce?
It's terrible. It's terrible. I mean, it's terrible because it's sad. I mean, it's so sad it's a real reminder. Forget the bugs. It's a real reminder that Gush Katif is unfortunately no longer producing lettuce that had been, purely selfish perspective that has been one of the, major contributions that the people of Gush Katif has made over the last few years. So what people are doing with Roman lettuce on Pesach is what they should be doing all year round at this point, and that is checking. Checking Roman lettuce is not as difficult as checking other vegetables. There are, guidelines and rules that have been, produced and distributed by all the kashrus organizations. There are special soaps that, obviously it sounds a little disgusting, but I think by this point everybody realizes that there are special vegetable cleaning soaps that are available. They're kosher for Pesach as well. And it's a little more work, but there's no alternative. There are no romaine lettuces right now that are under hashgacha that are acceptable by the major kashrus organizations. There are certain bags of lettuce that somebody told me are sold in Muncie, which have a stamp by one of the local rabbis, I think Rabbi Teitelbaum, I don't remember who. So I checked with the OU and they said that they're accepting that for the iceberg but not for the romaine. So the romaine lettuce is still, everybody's on their own. It looks like it. Like we used to do. Or like we should have done. Although, right. No, but Gush Katif had been, they figured out how, because they were growing it in the sand and in the... it could be they did, but I don't think it's going to come out. It's not going to come, you will not find it as readily as you had in the past. Yeah. Have they maintained their position, or have they pulled their hashgacha? I mean, I was told that they're still there. So listen, I'm going to tell you what I told everyone, and that is far be it for me. I'm on tape. I'm not far be it for me to tell you not to rely on Rabbi Heinemann. I'm not going to tell you not to rely on Rabbi Heinemann. I'm just, I think that people need to understand and appreciate and be aware that. I did my research into this, and I spoke to people on the inside at the major kashrus organizations, including the OU and the KFK. That's it. But I spoke to a few people in both those places, and they all insisted it's not a question of politics. It's not against a particular rabbi, a group of rabbis. It was just, and it's not that they're not even arguing the psiyus. Are there bugs? Aren't there bugs? They're arguing on how many bugs there have to be in order for that to, warrant, throwing out a batch or rechecking a batch, etc. And, he appears to be, in the minority among the major kashrus organizations. So, if someone's more comfortable relying on that, I should have presented originally, it is an option. It is an option. It's just, it was very, very one-sided. I think actually, I still haven't clarified with Rabbi Willig what his official position is, but I've heard from others that Rabbi Willig is also rather lenient in this regard, which is something I would consider very significant. I just don't know the part as to what his position is. But it's not as if there's nothing to discuss. But that, of course, would still require romaine lettuce with the starkei. Right. Yeah.
Not the crackers. Not the matzah shiro.
Right. What are they?
I think they're matzahs with the
shaker. Yeah, matzahs. Yeah, it's like eating pieces of bread. If that's what they are, it's like. No, you would have to eat a certain amount to bench, and you would have to eat a certain amount to wash with a bracha. So to wash with a bracha, you would have to, let's say, eat. I don't know how big the crackers are. Kabetza. So. 5, 6, maybe even a few more. But to make a hamotzi, if it's matzah, even to taste it, you would make a hamotzi and you would wash without a bracha, and to bench also, you would want to have a few of them. I don't know the size. I don't want to say how many, but more than probably one or two in order to bench. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm a little confused. This is kind of new to me. I'm just for people mentioning pushing brand names. So is this romaine lettucine just for pre-washed, pre-packaged stuff?
Exactly.
Or just buy like the regular, so there's not washed or packaged meat?
You definitely can, and you can check that. But to make life easy, some of the companies produce pre-washed, which for some time had been recognized as being acceptable as far as the bug checking is concerned, but recently has come under some... By the way, it's just mentioned, I've been trying for actually a few months now to arrange with one kosher organization, and it didn't work out, to have a bug checking seminar here in the shul. Didn't work out, but the OU has agreed to take our suggestion, and we are tentatively looking at a date in early May, right after. I would want it to be before Yom Tov, but hopefully it'll be a nice opportunity for people to come out and to see, you know, what the issues are. What I would like to happen, this was and that's what they claim they're going to do, is literally, I mean, send someone to Stop and Shop and buy vegetables and, you know, let the experts show us, A, where the bugs are, and how to check, and what can be checked and what can't be. I know there's a lot of confusion, and I certainly, again, I'm not an expert bug checker, but, you know, it's an important issue, and hopefully we'll be given some hands-on training soon. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know where, but that is available. If you want to know, I can try to find out. Bug checking light. I think that's really for people who do a lot at once. I know that it makes life a little easier. Right. I think if you're doing a normal household amount, that's fine. I mean, it's when people who do bug checking for a living, and there are people who do that, you know, use special lights, you know, just to, you know, to keep their sanity. Well, I'm not really sure it helps, but yeah.
You can.
You can wash any lettuce. All lettuce is kosher, but it has to be checked properly for bugs. Yeah.
Just to go back to the liquid cosmetic, like,
mm-hmm.
whatever, is that a problem with cloning as well, or just...
It could be. Yeah, it could be. Right, that does, but you wouldn't have to necessarily go through everyone. What you could do is anything that was questionable, put aside, and you're including that in your mechiras chametz. So you don't have to actually look through the book. If you just decide anything that has alcohol, I'm just going to put aside, I don't really care, in or out. That's fine. But you don't want to use it. Yeah?
Regarding the yotzei and matzah, how big is that size?
So it's anywhere from a third of a matzah to a half of a matzah. And I say anywhere from because there are different opinions. I would say that if you're able to eat the half, you know, then that's one kezayah, so wonderful. If you're not, so a third of a regular circle hand shmura matzah, according to most. Rabbi Willie gave a shear here recently in Teaneck, and he was comfortable with the smaller shear. That would also be acceptable. But you know, being that that's very hard to gauge, and it's hard, usually they don't break evenly, and there is some, you know, there are some differences in size between various matzah bakeries, and so it may be best to go closer with the half. That's as one kezias, as far as one kezias is concerned. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So I don't remember the measurements offhand, but they're in that booklet that I sent out to you. And if you want, I'll look it up because I have it here. But I mean, there are those are easier to measure in inches, and you bring a ruler to the table if you want. Yeah. Had a kasha then? Yeah. Yeah, one thing I'll tell you though, if you're going to kosher your microwave, which according to many you may, the bowl on the bottom plate needs to be either replaced or covered, you know, for the entirety of Pesach with maybe double layer of saran wrap or something like that. That can, because it's glass, we don't kosher glass, but the assuming the microwave is... it's not glass?
Yeah.
Oh. Whatever works, just make sure it's covered. Okay? No, that's it?
Is there a shul-wide kosher?
Yeah, Sunday night, 5:30 to 8, I believe. Okay, have a chag kosher v'sameach. Obviously, if you have any other questions, you know how to find me, and...